Sloane's little, "I'll do some research," might have fooled everyone else, but not me. Sergeant Gravehopper was only too happy to agree to fire off a text when he saw the underhanded little librarian pulling out of the parking lot on her way to a mysterious Wednesday afternoon meeting. "Here she is," Hank, my driver, announced when the Jeep roared into the parking lot of the Frouse Correctional Center. "I'll call you back, Nolan," I said, and disconnected. Sloane had her music loud and sunglasses on, not a care in the world, thinking she could just ride to someone's rescue without bothering to think of her own safety first. I wasn't going to stand for that again. She was frantically digging through her gigantic, "I'd rather be reading" tote on the passenger seat when I approached her Jeep window. I peered in and caught a glimpse of her phone screen in her lap. It was an internet search for what not to bring to prison visiting hours. With an eye roll, I rapped on her window. Startled, Sloane jolted, and the contents of her bag exploded everywhere. On an aggrieved sigh, I opened her door. She stared up at me, her jaw slack, her sunglasses askew. I waited. "What are you doing here?" she demanded, finally regaining the power of speech. "Waiting for you." "How? Why?" "That innocent little librarian routine might work on your friends, but it doesn't work on me." She scoffed and started shoveling female paraphernalia back into her bag. "I don't have an innocent little librarian routine." "Did you tell Naomi and Lena that you were coming?" "No, but did you tell Nash or Knox?" She stopped shoveling. Her chin jutted out. "No," she said. "You went behind everyone's backs because you decided you knew better than everyone else. Not the best way to begin your partnership." Judging from her expression, she knew I was right and wasn't happy about it. "Are you going to lecture me to death or leave me alone so I can continue to fuck everything up?" She tried to angrily exit the vehicle, only to be held back by her seatbelt. I reached across her and released it. "Neither. Let's go." "No freaking way, Lucifer. I'm not letting you go in there. You'll scare this poor woman out of her wits with your disapproving death glare."
"You're not going in there without me," I said succinctly.
"Yes, I am," she spat. She turned away from me and tried to wrestle her bag across the seat.
"Leave it. You can't take it in with you," I said as I pulled out my phone.
"What are you doing?" she asked.
"Calling Naomi." My thumb hovered over the call button.
"Damn it!
Did you just stomp your foot?" I asked. Sloane's comfort with expressing anger had always intrigued me. But I guess one was free to express their anger when one could control it.
"I was picturing your foot under mine," she shot back.
"Either I go in there with you, or you turn around and drive home. Those are your only two choices." She crossed her arms over her chest and glared up at me. Her gaze slid to the prison entrance. Her lips pursed.
"You wouldn't make it," I advised.
She dropped her arms and fisted her hands at her sides.
"Fine, you can come in, but you can't glare or growl or roll your eyes, and definitely no speaking."
"May I breathe?"
"I'd prefer if you didn't," she said.
"We're supposed to be in the midst of a truce," I pointed out.
"What truce involves you ambushing me in the parking lot of a women's correctional facility?"
She had a very small, practically insignificant point. "If I had called you to discuss this, would you have even answered?" I already knew the answer.
"Probably not," she admitted.
"Then let's deal with the situation at hand. I'm going in there with you. End of story," I snapped.
"Gee, maybe try to turn down the charm there, Master of the Universe. You might dazzle this woman into a faint."
I shut the door of her Jeep and gestured toward the front of the prison. "Let's go." We crossed the asphalt side by side, heading toward the monstrous monument of security. Earth-brown sandstone and concrete formed the towering facility walls beyond the double barbed wire fences. Women in beige jumpsuits huddled in groups in the dismal yard. The asphalt inside the fences was crumbling, dead weeds poking up through the cracks. Sloane stopped suddenly on the sidewalk.
"Why are you here?"
she asked again. "You already asked me that," I reminded her. She shook her head, sending that thick blonde ponytail swinging. Fine, it's Wednesday. Why aren't you ruling the corporate world? And you can't stand me, so what does it matter to you if I screw up this partnership with my friends? I'd think you'd be happy to watch me crash and burn. If you manage to make a mess of things, there's a chance you could be essentially setting your friend's money on fire. More importantly, there's a woman behind those walls who might suffer because of it. She closed her eyes and took a breath. You've buried and forgotten so many things, I just assumed you were over that as well. She was wrong. I'd buried and forgotten nothing. Instead, I'd used it all as fuel. There are some things we never get over, some things we hide from the light, I said, patting my pocket only to remember I'd left my cigarette in the car. Sloane lifted her gaze to the heavy gray clouds and wrinkled her nose. Her stud was a pale pink today. I take it you used your creepy spy network to dig into Mary Louise's case, she guessed. I may have glanced at some files. My team had done a fast, deep dive, and I'd managed to pore over their findings between everything else I'd had to do today. By all accounts, Mary Louise Upshaw was a model prisoner who used her time inside to earn 2 degrees and start a creative writing program for her fellow inmates. My own legal counsel had reviewed her sentence and found it absolute bullshit, which meant the justice-seeking Sloane was probably about to have her heart shattered. So you think we might have a case? She pressed. I think a lot rides on what she has to say, I hedged. The visitation room was more depressing than I'd anticipated. There were 2 rows of scarred folding tables sandwiched between cracked and faded vinyl chairs. The industrial tile floor was stained and peeling. Some of the ceiling tiles were missing between flickering fluorescent lights. There was something that looked suspiciously like mold climbing the walls under the glass block windows. Sloane was clicking her pen and gnawing on her lower lip, her eyes wide behind her glasses. With a sigh, I gripped the back of her chair and pulled it and her into my side. She stopped clicking her pen and frowned up at me. She'd always had that little line between her eyebrows that deepened when she was deep in thought, or pissed off at me. I wanted to run my finger over it. There's nothing to be afraid of, I told her. I'm not afraid. I looked down pointedly at the denim-clad leg that was jiggling a mere inch from my own. Fine, I'm not afraid. I'm nervous, okay? What do you have to be nervous about? You get to walk out of here. Thank you, Captain Obvious. But what if she's wonderful? What if she really is in here based on some gross injustice? What if she's lost all these years of her life to an unfair sentence? Then you'll help her. She went back to chewing on her lower lip for a few moments and then shifted to face me. Her knee was pressing into my thigh. Those green eyes were earnest. What if her sentence was unfairly harsh, but she's a terrible person? I felt myself softening toward her. Just like her father, she wanted to make a difference in the lives of strangers. But Sloane didn't have Simon's unlimited capacity for forgiveness. Neither did I. Then we'll talk afterward and figure out the best way forward. There's no point wasting any mental energy on a scenario that hasn't played out yet. She frowned. You strike me as the kind of man who goes into every situation having considered every possible scenario. My lips quirked. It's a luxury of someone who has no human feelings. Lucian, I'm serious. As am I. You approach this conversation your way, and I'll approach it mine. We'll discuss it later. For now, all you need to do is ask questions and listen. I don't want to give her false hope. You won't, I assured her. It was a lie. One look at Sloane's earnest face, those eager eyes, and Mary Louise Upshaw was going to feel what I had felt at 17. Hope. The heavy metal door on the far end of the room opened, and a woman in a beige jumpsuit entered. My throat felt dry and tight. She was white, with thick, wavy chestnut-brown hair streaked with gray. Without the jumpsuit, she would have looked like anyone's middle-aged mom. The guard pointed to us, and a look of curiosity flitted across her features. She headed in our direction, and I felt Sloane stop breathing. I slid my arm around the back of her chair and gave her shoulder a squeeze. It's just a conversation, I said, keeping my voice low. I felt her relax infinitesimally. Hello? Mary Louise said, pulling out the chair across from us and sitting.
Hi,
Sloane's voice squeaked. She cleared her throat and began again. Mary Louise, I'm Sloane Walton, and this is my associate, Lucien Rollins. We had some questions about your case and sentence.
Are you reporters?
Mary Louise asked, cocking her head. Sloane's gaze slid to me.
No.
There was a guard stationed across the room, looking blank-faced and bored. It made my skin crawl.
Lawyers?
Mary Louise looked hopeful. Sloane shook her head.
No, just...
She looked at me again, help written in those lovely green eyes. I leaned forward. Ms. Upshaw, we recently stumbled across a mention of your case. Did you ever meet with a Simon Walton? He was an attorney. She shook her head slowly.
No, I've only had public defenders. Simon was my son's mentor. He helped Alan get into law school. He unfortunately passed away recently.
Sloane tensed against me, as if bracing for the inevitable blow of grief. It looked as though Simon had taken an interest in your case, specifically your sentencing, I continued. Can you shed any light as to why that might be? Mary Louise shrugged and interlaced her fingers on the table.
Maybe because it was one of the harshest sentences for possession and trafficking in the state of Virginia in the last 35 years?
Sloane cleared her throat.
You said initially that the drugs found in your car during your traffic stop weren't yours, and then you changed your statement and pled guilty.
Mary Louise studied us with narrowed eyes for a beat.
Who are you? Why are you here?
I'm Sloane Walton. Simon was my father. I think he wanted to help you, but he got sick before he could.
Mary Louise took a breath, sympathy shining in her eyes.
Your father was a good man. He changed my son's life, so I can only imagine what he did for you. I'm so sorry for your loss.
Sloane reached across the table with one hand. Mary Louise took it and squeezed. And there it was. That sneaky bastard that would only lead to disappointment, devastation, hope. It bloomed over both women's faces, and I resigned myself to the fact that things were going to get messy and expensive.
I met Alan the day of my dad's funeral,
Sloane told her.
You raised a great kid.
Mary Louise's face rearranged into maternal pride.
I know it. I wish I could take credit for it, but I've been in here since he was 16.
What happened the night you were arrested?
Sloane asked.
We're not here to judge. We want to help if we can.
Mary Louise shook her head.
Honey, I appreciate that, but I've been in here 11 years. I don't believe in miracles anymore.
We're not offering a miracle, I clarified.
Anything that would get me out of this place one day early would be a miracle, she insisted.
Then tell us what happened that night, I said. Under the table, Sloane's hand found my thigh and squeezed, hard. Please, I added briskly. Mary Louise closed her eyes and reached up to rub the back of her neck.
My son was 15. His father and I had just split up and he fell in with the wrong crowd. He had plans. He was going to be the first kid in my family to go to college.
Sloane's knee pressed more firmly against my leg. I kept my arm where it was on the back of her chair, but allowed my fingers to brush her shoulder. I felt better, less anxious in here, touching her. Mary Louise locked eyes with me.
He was a good kid, a really good kid.
Good kids can make stupid choices, I said. Sloane tensed.
I was working two jobs at the time. I wasn't around as much as I should have been. I missed the signs. He'd started experimenting. Nothing too crazy. But his friend told Alan he had a way they could make some money. Alan being Alan knew times were tough and thought this was a way he could help out the family. They took my car from the parking lot while I was working third shift to meet some dealer somewhere.
She interlaced her fingers and rested them on the table.
I got pulled over on the highway halfway between work and home. I had a headlight out. It turns out they decided it was safer to keep the drugs in my car. I had no idea I was driving around with almost 5 pounds of marijuana in my back seat. I didn't even know what a dime bag was until I came here. I've learned a lot of things in here.
There was no blame, no malice in her tone. She was simply stating facts.
When you found out the drugs belonged to your son, that's when you changed your plea, isn't it? Sloan guessed.
Mary Louise nodded.
He had a whole bright future ahead of him. I wasn't going to let one mistake ruin all that.
I felt a tightness in my chest. The sacrifice this woman had willingly made for her son was unfathomable, at least in my family.
I had a public defender. The prosecutor offered me a deal. If I pled guilty, she would recommend 1 year with time served and the possibility of early parole. I was only supposed to do 6 months max. 6 months, and then I would be home. I'd see my baby's high school graduation. I'd send him off to college.
What happened to the deal? Sloan asked, leaning forward.
Mary Louise shrugged.
The prosecutor made the recommendation, but for whatever reason, the judge didn't like the deal. He said drugs had been infiltrating his community for far too long, and it was time to set an example for criminals like me.
Sloan winced. My free hand balled into a fist in my lap. I, too, knew what it was like to be at the mercy of a twisted justice system. Mary Louise held up her palms.
So here I am, in year 11 of a 20-year sentence. But I wake up every day so glad that it's me here and not my baby.
It was too warm in this room. My tie was too tight. I needed air.
I'm so sorry this happened to you, Sloan said.
Do you know if the drugs or bags were fingerprinted? I asked. She shook her head.
I'm sure it wasn't. From my arrest to me changing my plea was only a few days. I doubt any evidence was processed. My second public defender recommended that we appeal. He thought we could prove I didn't do it without implicating my son. He was digging into the case, getting ready to file a motion. Then he got a job at his mother-in-law's firm and moved to New York, she said wearily. I'm on public defender number 4 now, and she's so overworked it takes her a week to return my calls.
That's really unfair.
But you don't seem bitter,
Sloan said, shooting me a nervous glance. She was about to promise this woman the world. I removed my arm from the back of her chair and squeezed her leg under the table.
Bitterness is a waste of energy. All I can do is make the best of this situation.
It looks as if you've kept busy, I said, flipping open the file I'd brought with me. Her eyebrows lifted.
Is that a dossier on me? Where did you...
Never mind,
Sloan said before turning back to Mary Louise.
What have you been doing since your sentence?
I got an associate's degree in business and one in creative writing.
You founded a creative writing program for inmates, I added. She smiled wryly.
I did. But that was more for me than anything. I like talking about writing, and in here I have a captive audience.
Your son, he's in law school now? A slow, proud smile spread across her face, making her look younger, lighter.
In his last year at Georgetown. He says as soon as he graduates, he's going to find a way to get me out.
We have to help her,
Sloan said as we exited the prison. An involuntary shudder worked its way up my spine when the heavy door closed behind us. Had it not been for Sloan's father, this could have been my fate. I turned up my coat collar and sucked in a deep breath of icy winter wind. I could breathe again. It felt miraculous. Sloan's cheeks were flushed pink with excitement.
I mean, obviously it's going to take a lot of time and energy
and money, I added. I could give it to her, but she wouldn't take it, not if she knew it came from me.
And money,
she agreed.
But we can't let her sit behind bars, not for protecting her son, and certainly not for another decade.
Her eyes sparkled behind her glasses. She hadn't been this excited in my presence since we were teenagers. It was another sting of loss.
I guess I need to talk to Naomi, Lena, and Steph first. Then I'll call Maeve. We'll have to find a lawyer, a good one.
As she babbled on, I thought about how much her energy reminded me of Simon's. Simon had loved nothing more than a challenge when justice was at stake. It appeared the apple hadn't fallen far from the tree. The Waltons were good people. They weren't stained with bad blood, as I was. Your father would be proud. The word lodged itself in my throat, and it took effort to let it loose. It was the greatest compliment I could think to give.
Sloan stopped her bubbly, one-sided conversation to gawk up at me.
Thank you, she said finally. Her eyes narrowed. Are you okay?
I'm fine, I said testily.
You don't look fine, you look pale.
I always look fine, I insisted, as I guided her across the parking lot. She glanced back at the building we'd just left.
I'm sorry. I didn't really think about it, but I guess being in a prison even as a visitor could be triggering after...
You aren't going to need just an attorney. I couldn't stand the pity I heard in her voice. You'll need an entire legal team.
That sounds expensive.
Justice isn't cheap, Pixie. Her chin jutted out.
I'll find a way, she said.
I have no doubt. She fished her car keys out of her jacket pocket when we arrived at her Jeep. I happen to know a few lawyers who specialize in appeals and commutations. I'll send you some names. I'd used one of them to seal my own record. She frowned, and the line between her eyes returned.
Thanks.
It sounded like a question. What? I demanded.
You liked her, didn't you?
She prompted. I found her story interesting. Sloan threw her head back and let out a noise that was half groan and half snarl.
Can you... just for once, say what you're thinking. I'm not going to take your opinion and use it against you or try to scam you out of a kajillion dollars. I just want to know what you think.
Why? There were reasons I guarded my words. The same reasons I walked through life with a poker face. She crossed her arms.
Because you're a rich megalomaniac who plays dirty with politicians all day long, I assume you see things from a different angle than a small-town librarian.
Her story, if it's true, is compelling. Even if it's not entirely true, the sentence was excessive, and she's done nothing while serving her term to indicate she's a dangerous criminal. With the proper team, you should be able to at least shorten her sentence significantly. Sloan smirked.
There. Was that so hard?
Excruciating. I had a headache forming at the back of my head. I didn't like being anywhere near prisons. Even being able to walk out didn't help shake the memories of a broken, traumatized teen.
She did it to protect her son when he was a stupid teenager. I mean, what parent wouldn't do that for their stupid teenager?
She flinched the moment the words left her mouth, but she didn't apologize.
I mean, what good parent wouldn't do whatever it took to...
She was making it worse, and she knew it. Shut up, Sloan.
Shutting up, she confirmed.
It lasted nearly a full 5 seconds before she opened her mouth again.
What would you do next if you were me?
She asked, toying with the button on her coat. I'd talk to the sun again. That had her perking up. With your partners, I added.
Of course with my partners, she said haughtily.
I glanced down at my watch. I hadn't wrapped this up in time to take the call from New York. Nolan better not have fucked it up. If he hadn't fucked it up, the rest of my afternoon was open. Are you hungry? Do you want coffee? I asked. Her spine straightened.
Shit! What time is it?
Nearly 3. She unlocked her car.
Damn it! I'm going to be late for my date.
Your date, I repeated. I hadn't meant to. The words had just slipped out. They were accompanied by an irrational burst of irritation.
Yeah,
she said, turning to examine her reflection in the side mirror.
You know, meet for food, make awkward conversations about what you wanted to be when you grew up, and what your favorite appetizers are, a date.
She yanked the tie out of her hair and bent at the waist, shaking all that silver-tipped blonde out. Who is this date with? Sloan flipped right side up, looking less like an innocent librarian and more like a bedheaded vixen.
Some guy named Gary? No, wait. Gary is later. This is...
She opened the door of her vehicle to grab a lipstick out of her cup holder. She uncapped it.
Massimo.
She slicked the red over her lips with an expert hand. Massimo? He sounded like a man with a gold chain woven into his chest hair who wore sunglasses indoors. You're meeting a stranger from the internet alone. Irritation was giving way to a simmering panic. It was hard to breathe again.
That's kind of how these dates work, she said, grabbing onto my arm for balance while she towed off her sneakers.
The socks with cats and books came next. She released me to toss her discarded footwear in the back seat and produce another pair of shoes. purple ones with stick-thin heels. The coat came next. This she threw at me. I caught it, despite the feeling of anxiety that was blooming like a fucking flower.
"Have you really never done the dating app thing?" she asked.
"Do I look like I use dating apps?"
"You look like you hire high-priced call girls to act out your lewd fantasies."
"And you look like..." I lost my train of thought when she whipped her black turtleneck over her head. She was wearing a thin-strapped, lacy camisole that dipped low over the tops of her full breasts.
"I look like what?"
she prodded, sliding her arms through a hunter green cardigan in a chunky knit. There were no buttons, nothing to close the sweater over her fantasy-inducing cleavage. "What?" I repeated. My mouth was dry, and my headache was raging in full force now.
"You were about to insult me. Hit me with it, big guy, before I go meet the future Mr. Sloan Walton."
I closed my eyes. Her nicknames for me the past several years had been limited to Lucifer and Hey Asshole. "You can't be serious with this emergency quest for a husband," I told her.
"Spoken like a man who has all the time in the world to decide when to start a family."
"I'm never starting a family." I blamed the dark cleft between her breasts for my uncalculated confession. She paused, mid-tug on the hem of her tank.
"Really?"
"That's not the point. You can't go meet a stranger for a date. What if he's a predator?" She fluffed her hair out of the neck of her cardigan. It made the generous curves of her breasts threaten to spill over the top of her shirt. Swarthy Massimo was going to take one look at her and do or say something stupid, and then I was going to have to ruin his fucking life.
"It's fine. People meet strangers on the internet all the time now, and hardly any of them end up murdered."
"Sloan!" I barked. She grinned at me. A happy, smug, full-fledged smile. Jesus, between her breasts and the smile, too many gold chains Massimo was going to feel like he'd hit the fucking lottery.
"I'll be fine. Geez, for someone who doesn't want a family, you're sure acting dad-like."
"What if he doesn't like to read?"
"Then I guess I'll just have to keep shopping for a husband."
"I'm fucking serious, Sloan. What precautions are you taking? Where is this date? Who knows you'll be there?" She gripped my coat by the lapels.
"Calm the fuck down, Lucifer. It's in Lawlerville. Lena and Naomi are tracking my phone with a locator app. I sent them screenshots of his profile and our chat. I'm texting them a picture of him when I get there and proof of life messages every 30 minutes. If things go downhill, Steph is on deck to call me with a fake emergency 45 minutes into the date, because I can handle pretty much anything for 45 minutes, right? If things go really badly, I have pepper spray and a big fat hardback in my bag. Is that good enough, suit daddy?"
"That's reasonably thorough," I admitted when she released me.
"Good. Now, how do I look?"
She spread her arms out wide. She looked beautiful. Fun, spunky, smart, sweet, funny. Fucking breathtaking. I hated Massimo's fucking guts. She rolled her eyes.
"Never mind, I forgot who I was asking."
"Suit, daddy?" Her words had finally sunk into my reeling brain.
16. Crunchy soup and bad first dates. Sloan. Massimo was a fraud. Instead of the 6-foot-tall glasses-wearing gourmet cook hobbyist with a love of popular thriller authors, I was seated across the table from a 5-foot-4 man-child who had just ordered buttered noodles because marinara was yucky.
"My mom makes the best buttered noodles, so if you want to get with this," he said, gesturing at his sweater that looked as if it had been intimate with a weed whacker, "you better learn how to melt that butter just right."
My God, what had I done to deserve this karma? All I wanted to do was meet a nice hot guy, have kids, and get a woman out of prison. Was that too much to ask? At least the restaurant was nice. It was part cafe, part Italian restaurant, part wine bar, with checkered tablecloths and the comforting smells of garlic and espresso. If I didn't have to drive all the way back to Knockemout, I would have been ordering the largest glass of Pinot Grigio they had. "Yeah," I said. "So you said you're a Grisham fan. Did you read his latest?
Who?
Grisham. John Grisham, I prompted. He was squinting at me through bloodshot eyes. The famous legal thriller writer. You said A Time to Kill was one of your favorites.
Oh, he said a little too loudly. That was actually my mom. I don't like to, like, you know, communicate. So she writes all my texts and emails for me. Sometimes she even impersonates me on the phone.
I don't know you well enough to know if you're joking, I said. He flailed his arms at the server.
Hey, man, I know we, like, just ordered some food, but I'm starving. Is there any way I could get, like, 2 baskets of bread? Oh, and some fried mushrooms. And you know what? Throw in a bowl of soup, but not, like, something mushy. I like crunchy soup.
The server's gaze slid to me. We met online, I explained.
Got it, he said to me, then turned back to Massimo. I'll be back with your bread, mushrooms, and crunchy soup. Cool, man. Thanks.
The server disappeared, and I was left alone with the very hungry, red-eyed mama's boy. Are you high? I asked.
You know it. 24/7, baby. Living the blaze life, relaxing with the reefer, sparking up Saturday.
It's Wednesday. I wanted to stand up and walk out, but I had actual concerns about what damage he would inflict on himself and others without any adult supervision.
It's cool, baby. It don't matter what day it is because you're hot and I've got buttered noodles coming.
He reached into his messenger bag and pulled out a half-eaten brownie.
You want to share the rest of this edible?
No, I don't. Did you drive here? And if so, do you remember hitting any people-shaped objects? His giggle was so high-pitched I almost didn't hear the buzzing of my phone in my bag. I pounced on it, grateful that Steph was calling me early with his fake emergency. But it wasn't a call from Steph. It was a text from Lucian. Lucian.
Is Massimo husband material?
Massimo put his chin in his hands.
Oh, hey, listen. I, like, forgot my wallet, and my mom totally withheld my allowance this week because I accidentally set the basement on fire. You don't mind picking up the tab, do you? Oh, and I need you to drive me home.
Under normal circumstances, I wouldn't have even replied to Lucian's text, let alone allowed the man the tiniest glimpse into my personal life, but this was an emergency. Me. He's not even adult material, thinking about setting a fire in the ladies' restroom and making a run for it. I'm not going to survive until Steph's fake emergency. Lucian.
Where are you?
My heart skipped a beat. Me. Vino Italiano, why? Lucian.
Stay there.
Stay there? As in stay here with Massimo the Mooch? I glanced up from my phone. Is your real name Massimo? He let out another guffaw.
Nah, it's actually Eugene. You can call me Huge. You know, pronounced like the Pittsburgh Huge. Mom thought I'd get more chicks as a Massimo. Your crunchy soup, sir,
the server said, setting down a bowl of soup filled with at least 9 packs of crushed-up saltines.
Cool, man. I'll make sure this pretty lady with the awesome rack tips well. What's your name again?
He asked me.
Sloan.
Oh, my God. Okay, that's it, I said, throwing my napkin down on the table.
If you're going to punch him, can you try not to get any blood on the tablecloth?
The server asked me.
The last couple that sat here was on a blind date, too, and she dumped an entire bottle of wine over his head. I'm out of fresh linens.
The bell on the door jingled, and in strode Lucian Rollins, looking just as beautiful as he had when I left him less than an hour ago. Every woman in the place, including the lesbian couple and the 92nd birthday attendees in the corner, stopped what they were doing and stared. I, too, fell under his spell as he swept toward me. His eyes were all silver fire. His mouth was pressed in that mean, firm line that made women vie for a smile. His coat today was charcoal gray and billowed behind him like a superhero cape. His trousers were a lighter gray and fit extremely well in the crotch. I hadn't noticed that at the prison.
"Man, these guys make a good crunchy soup,"
Huge said through a mouthful of saltines. "Huh?" I said, not bothering to tear my eyes away from Lucian.
"Sloane,"
he greeted me with that gravelly rasp. "Hi." Huge turned and found himself face to crotch with Lucian.
"Your pants look expensive,"
Huge announced to the entire restaurant. Lucian shot me a smirk. "Don't you smirk at me. Apparently his mother made his profile."
"Dude, I'm kind of in the middle of something with Rackety Ann here. We're vibing." "Rackety Ann?"
Lucian repeated.
"He's talking about her chest,"
the server offered helpfully. Lucian rolled his eyes and clenched his teeth. He reached out and grabbed Huge by the collar and hauled him out of his seat.
"Don't get blood on the tablecloth," I warned.
"We're just going to take a little walk,"
Lucian promised. He looked at me.
"Stay."
With flaming cheeks, I watched him march Huge out the door like a puppet. The rest of the diners were riveted. I was debating texting Lena and Naomi when the woman at the table next to me leaned over.
"Girl, I don't know what's happening right now, but I'm a nurse, and if you don't go home with tall, dark, and tight crotch, I'm going to check you for head trauma."
The man next to her nodded.
"I'm her husband, and even I think suit guy is fucking hot."
"Noted," I said. A minute later, Lucian returned alone, looking moderately cheerful. He pulled out Huge's chair and sat. I bit my lip.
"Did you crumple him up and throw him in the gutter?"
"I arranged for my driver to take your date home in my car."
I covered my face with my hands and groaned.
"I took the liberty of canceling the stoned gentleman's noodles and brought you this,"
the server said. I dropped my hands to see him handing Lucian a menu and a bottle of wine. Lucian thanked him, and the man scampered off, obviously thrilled by the lack of bloodshed.
"That was the worst first date in the history of first dates," I said.
"You'd be surprised," Lucian said.
"Oh, please, you don't date. You pick up a rich guy trophy girlfriend takeout menu and place an order. This is different. This is humiliating and a total waste of time."
"What did you expect?"
he asked, looking amused.
"Also, where can I get a copy of the rich guy trophy girlfriend takeout menu?"
"Don't be funny or nice. I don't want your pity."
"I'm not pitying you, Pixie. I'm enjoying your misery."
"Well, you're doing it too nicely. Be meaner."
"Fine. You should have walked out the door 30 seconds after your introduction. What were you thinking?"
"I was trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. And I was really hungry."
"What a coincidence. So am I."
"Are you seriously planning to have lunch with me right now?"
I asked. He closed the menu.
"Yes, but rest assured, it's not the company I'm interested in. It's the chicken piccata."
The server reappeared with two wine glasses and took Lucian's order while he poured us each a glass. I accepted my wine and leaned back in my chair.
"I can't believe I'm about to say this, but thank you for riding to my rescue twice today."
He arched an eyebrow.
"I'm impressed. You said that without wincing."
"I was wincing on the inside."
Was Lucian Rollins flirting with me? Or was he just being human, and it was so far from his usual icy devil asshat routine that even the most benign, polite gesture felt like it was sexually charged?
"Then you're welcome," he said.
I tipped my glass toward him. He raised his at me.
"Okay, enough of this being nice to each other. It makes my skin crawl, I said with a shudder. Lucian chuckled, and I nearly fumbled my glass. Clearly, I had tumbled into an alternate reality, like Sputnik's Sweetheart by Haruki Murakami. Was this a new world where Lucian Rollins and I got along?
Agreed, he said.
So, about Mary Louise, if I talk to her son and her story checks out, what would the next step be? Hypothetically, I said.
You need to hire an attorney with experience in cases like this. Someone who has the time to dedicate and a good rapport with both judges and juries. They'd need to build a team of associates, paralegals, and interns.
You're saying I need a team of unicorns.
And don't forget about the money. Appeals are expensive.
We're sitting in a pretty nice nest egg, I bragged.
If it's less than a 7-figure nest egg, I wouldn't be so sure, he said.
I sputtered into my wine, narrowly avoiding a spill. $1 million?
Depending on how long the appeal process lasts, it could be more.
Are you fucking around? His eyes locked on mine.
I never fuck around about money.
Shit. I put down the wine and picked up my water. Shit.
I could be persuaded to...
No, I said. Definitely a concussion, the woman at the table next to us stage whispered to her husband.
He's like beautiful and handsome at the same time, her husband whispered back.
Why wouldn't you take money when it's offered, Sloane?
Because it was his. Because he'd hurt me. Because I'd hurt him. Because the last time our lives had gotten tangled up, neither of us had ever recovered. Because I said so. It was too bad Massimo turned out to be a big stoned phony because I was clearly ready to become a parent.
Still unnecessarily stubborn, I see, he said.
I think we've both proven on multiple occasions that we can't work together.
That doesn't mean you can't take my money to do something good.
That's exactly what it means, I said. We don't trust each other enough for money to change hands.
And whose fault is that?
He asked quietly. I think we both played a role. Our meals arrived, and we stared down at the plates before us. Lucian heaved a sigh.
Let's table this discussion for another time. I rarely get a Wednesday afternoon off, and I'd prefer to enjoy it.
I picked up my fork. Don't you already own half of the Eastern Seaboard? How much money do you need before you can afford to start taking afternoons off?
You're awfully judgmental for someone who agreed to a date with a man-boy called Huge.
Ugh, Naomi and Lena are going to have a field day with this, I grumbled. Though it was hard to be grumpy with a plate full of ravioli.
What are friends for if not making fun of us when we're at our worst?
He philosophized. It's not that. Well, not only that. They're so smug about their happily ever afters.
So are Knox and Nash, Lucian agreed. It's annoying.
When I meet my future husband, I'm going to have some dignity. I'm not going to get caught making out in public, and I certainly won't be shoving the joys of monogamy down the throats of my single friends, I said, plowing my way through the first pillowy cheese-stuffed ravioli. Though come to think of it, almost all my friends were in committed relationships. I frowned and chewed. When the hell had that happened? The endless parade of bridal showers, weddings, and baby showers had punctuated the past several years of my professional march toward library domination.
I was supposed to meet Knox at Honky Tonk 2 weeks ago. I got there early and found Mr. and Mrs. Morgan climbing out of his pickup truck wearing only half their clothes,
Lucian said as he pulled a piece of bread in half. I hid my laugh behind my napkin.
I FaceTimed Lena from a store to ask her opinion on a jacket. She answered the phone from the shower. I got an eyeful of Nash Jr. in the background.
Lucian shook his head. For future reference, when you're on a date, you should refrain from discussing other men's penises.
I choked out a laugh. Wow, Wednesday afternoon Lucian could almost pass for human.
His lips curved up ever so slightly. If you spread that around, I'll deny it.
Your secret is safe with me, I said. My statement had the effect of a record scratch. Lucian went very still, his eyes boring into mine, telling me what I already knew. He had trusted me, once, just like I'd trusted him. Neither one of us had any intention of making the same mistake again. I cleared my throat and focused on my plate. Lucian sliced through a delicate piece of chicken with surgical precision.
Why are you so intent on finding a husband? Why now?
Can't we just talk about the weather or something? I asked.
It's cold, he retorted. Why are you hunting a husband like it's a sport?
Because I've spent so much time on my career, I'm freaking out at how little time I have left to start a family.
And you need a family because...
Normally I'd have no problem calling him an inhuman robot monster with a wallet where his heart should be. However, I was keenly aware that we'd grown up in very different homes. He wasn't asking to be an asshole. Well, not only to be an asshole. The man across from me genuinely didn't understand the purpose a family served. Because I've always wanted one. I always assumed I'd have one. I want what my parents had. I want to give my mom grandkids who are so excited to see her they smash their sticky little faces up against the windows just to watch for her car. I want a house full of people. He grimaced and helped himself to a sip of wine.
That sounds horrible.
Which part?
Mostly the sticky part, but also the house full of people.
He shuddered. I couldn't help but smile. It's definitely not for everyone, but I'm Team Sticky Face. I love spending time with Chloe and Waylay and watching them awkwardly turn into slightly less feral, more hormonal people. We ate in silence for a few moments, which gave me plenty of time to spiral mentally. I could not believe I was sharing a meal with Lucian Rollins. He made eating sexy. No one in the real world could do that. Everyone looked like idiots trying to cram food into their faces. But not Lucian. The way he held his fork and knife, the way he never seemed to get anything stuck between his teeth, the way his lips parted just enough for the fork to pass between them. You know, it's not too late for you, I said, interrupting my stupid train of thought. You could start a family.
Or I could keep doing what I've been doing.
And what have you been doing? I asked, trying to dislodge a piece of parsley with my tongue.
Exactly what I want when I want.
You sound like an overgrown toddler, I pointed out.
At least I don't dress like a teenager who shops at yard sales, he teased.
Before I could take offense and then tell him I'd taken offense, I heard a faint buzzing noise. He reached inside his jacket and produced his phone to frown at the screen.
Excuse me a moment,
he said as if I were some business associate he had to be polite to.
What?
He answered. I didn't like when people couldn't be bothered with a greeting. How hard was it to say hi or hello or Lucifer's phone, Satan speaking? My dad used to answer every call to the house with a boisterous yellow. Lucian's frown deepened.
I see. When?
I almost felt bad for whoever was on the other end of the call, because whatever they were saying was not making him happy.
He looked as if he'd just won the world championship glaring contest and was pissed off about it.
Where?
His tone was clipped. He looked over my head at some unknown spot, still frowning.
Fine. Get me in.
He hung up, still looking grumpy as hell. Problem? I asked.
You could say that.
He picked up his knife and fork again. This time when he cut a bite of chicken, it was with controlled violence. Let me guess, the trophy girlfriend you ordered isn't available?
Close. The man who sold Duncan Hugo the list of law enforcement officers just turned up dead.
My fork dropped with a clatter. What happened to him? Who was he?
A low-level independent contractor criminal. His body was dumped in the Potomac. He was shot twice in the head.
Why are you getting calls about that? I asked, my blood running cold.
Because someone ordered a hit on my friend.
His voice was colder than the polar ice caps before global warming. Duncan Hugo is behind bars, and Tate Dilton is dead, I reminded him.
Anthony Hugo is the one who commissioned that list, and he's still out there operating his business.
Lucian, you can't just decide to go head-to-head with a mob boss, or whatever the appropriate terminology is.
As it happens, I'm uniquely suited to do exactly that,
he said, picking up his wine. The FBI is investigating him. You don't need to go make yourself a target.
It almost sounds like you care, Pixie.
Lucian, I'm serious.
So am I.
What can you do that the FBI can't? I asked.
For one, I can expedite things. My team isn't overworked and understaffed. We have the capabilities to find the right thread to pull on and point the FBI in that direction.
He looked at me, eyes narrowing.
I already regret telling you this.
What is Anthony Hugo going to do when he finds out that you're helping the FBI build a case against him?
Become irritated?
Don't play the blasé butthead with me. This guy is dangerous. There's a 3-part docuseries about him on YouTube that was never finished because the channel owners died in a mysterious house fire.
I'm perfectly capable of protecting myself, he insisted.
Now, maybe. But there had been a time when he hadn't been, when he'd been too busy protecting others to worry about himself. Old habits died hard, especially when the habit holder was a stubborn pain in the ass. His organization is rumored to be directly linked to a South American drug cartel, and his right-hand henchman is serving a life sentence for brutally murdering a federal witness and his family. My voice was getting higher pitched by the syllable.
Someone's done her homework,
he said, sounding not the least bit concerned. Of course I did. Nash is my friend, and Anthony Hugo is still out there walking around.
Then you understand why I'm doing what I'm doing.
But what if he comes after you? I pressed. He looked up at me, his eyes flat and cold.
I'll be ready.
If we were friends, I could argue with him. I could make him listen to reason. But we weren't. There was nothing I could do to make him take my opinion seriously. Nothing I could do to change his mind. I suddenly wasn't very hungry anymore. I don't suppose you're willing to talk about any of the precautions you're taking, I prodded.
I don't suppose I am.
Is he going to go after Nash again? Lucian sighed and put down his utensils.
I didn't come here to talk about this.
Well, tough shit, because you're here and we are talking about this.
All signs point to Hugo focusing on business as usual.
That's not a no.
I'm watching him. The FBI is watching him. His enemies are probably watching him to see if they can take advantage. It would be incredibly stupid of him to make a move right now. And Anthony Hugo might be many things, but he isn't stupid. Nash, Lena, Naomi, Waylay, they're all safe.
I crossed my arms. Are they all safe because Nash and Knox are taking precautions that the rest of us aren't aware of? Naomi and Lena would not be pleased when I told them. Of course, telling them would require me confessing to the worst first date of my entire life. Lucian raised an eyebrow.
I don't know why I bother asking you to trust me to handle this. You've never done anything I wanted you to do before.
He was baiting me, distracting me, trying to guide me away from my pointed questions with a pat on the head and a look-at-something-shiny redirection. I just don't understand what you can do that a law enforcement agency can't.
I have the budget and resources and technology the government wishes it had. I'm simply sharing some of my toys. By the way, he said, buttering a piece of bread, you'll need to drive me home since I loaned my car and driver to your date.
Did you at least bring your wallet? I asked, picking up my fork again.
17. Too close for comfort. Lucian. Duncan Hugo looked significantly the worse for wear since I'd last seen him being led in handcuffs to a police cruiser. The hair he'd dyed an earthy brown was showing a full inch of natural red root. He'd lost some weight, and the hunch of his shoulders hinted that his time behind bars had relieved him of some of his arrogance. The dark circles under his eyes almost made up for the fact that this was my second prison visit in 2 days. This prison was in better shape than yesterday's, I noted. It wasn't winning any design awards, but the furniture wasn't disintegrating, the paint wasn't lead-based, and there was a faint scent of industrial cleaner throughout the facility. It still made my skin crawl, my tie feel too tight against my throat. I focused on Nolan, who leaned against the wall, hands in his pockets. He hadn't managed to run my business into the ground yesterday, so when he'd insisted on joining me for this little field trip, I hadn't said no. I faced Duncan across the table in the interview room the FBI had arranged. It could have been me, I thought, as I studied him. If it weren't for the Waltons, I could easily have been the one on the opposite side of the table. Duncan hadn't had a Simon or a Karen or a Sloan. He'd had a father like mine. That was why I was here.
I said I wanted to talk to the feds, not some stuck-up dick in a suit. Duncan said, slumping in his chair like a 6-year-old on the verge of a temper tantrum. His baggy orange jumpsuit accentuated the red in his hair and scraggly beard.
I'm an ex-fed. Does that count? Nolan asked.
Didn't I shoot you? Duncan asked.
You missed, shithead. Your pal Dilton got lucky.
Duncan grunted.
Don't know which was worse, his aim or his personality.
I cleared my throat. Do you know who I am? I asked Duncan. His mouth pinched, but he nodded.
Yeah, I know who the fuck you are.
Then you can probably piece it together from there. You've already talked to the feds on several occasions, yet you remain essentially useless.
So they send Lucian Rollins in here to do what? Break my fucking kneecaps?
He picked up one of the loose cigarettes on the table and lit a match.
Watching Duncan's thin lips wrap around the filter was enough to make me consider skipping today's cigarette.
I'm here to dig into the space between your ears to see if there's anything useful squirreled away.
What the hell else do you assholes want? I gave you drop locations. I gave you names. It's not my fault if you're not doing shit about it.
The information you provided was street level. Any gutter rat would know it. It's almost like you're holding out or your father didn't trust you. Duncan pulled the cigarette out of his mouth. A tick appeared in his jaw.
What the fuck does it matter? I'm stuck in this shithole for a fuck ton of years.
Felix Metzer, I said.
Already told that FBI bitch. That's who I bought the list off of.
Did she mention that his body was fished out of the Potomac yesterday? The two slugs in his brain indicate it wasn't a boating accident. He held up his palms.
Hey, man. Don't look at me. My ass was in here.
From his position against the wall, Nolan rolled his eyes and shook his head. Someone was cleaning up their mess. I'm curious who that would be, I said.
Felix was into shit with every fucking one. What makes you think him getting whacked had anything to do with me?
He was last seen the day before you were arrested for trying to kill my friends.
Look, man, it was nothing personal.
You weren't even man enough to pull the trigger the first time around. Duncan scoffed.
It's called delegating. Bosses don't do the dirty work.
They do if they want to earn that title. I'd done my share of dirty work as I climbed the ladder of success. I'd earned the respect and the fear. He crossed his arms over his chest.
This chat has been real nice and all, but I'm over it.
What else do you have to do? Go back and stare at four walls?
Better than listening to this bullshit.
If you had two brain cells in that dumbass head of yours, you'd be all ears,
Nolan warned him. Your father doesn't see you as a threat, I said to Duncan.
Maybe you should make him reconsider that. Remind him who you are and that you're still dangerous to him.
Duncan shoved a hand through his hair.
Look, man, I tried. I lost, he won. That's the way it always goes.
Did we all have this wound from our fathers? Was it necessary for every son to challenge his father to become a man? Was there always a winner and a loser, or was there a different rite of passage, a different path to respect?
There's still time to change that, I told him.
He didn't fucking tell me shit, okay? He thought I was a fuck-up, a loser.
Duncan tapped the ash off his cigarette into the ashtray. So you wanted to show him that you were more, I prompted.
Yeah, and I fucked that up too.
The woe-is-me, defeated criminal routine set my teeth on edge.
You realize, if you don't give the feds something to work with, they'll transfer you out of this place to a federal facility, the kind where you're in a cell 23 hours a day.
I caught the nervous shift of his eyes.
They say where?
He asked, trying and failing to sound disinterested. I heard Lucrum. That's maximum security.
It makes this place look like a daycare center.
I saw its sister facility, Fraus. It wasn't pretty. The feet of Duncan's chair hit the floor.
I can't go there.
You won't have a choice, I pointed out.
I can't go to Lucrum. I won't last a fucking day.
You should have thought of that before you tried to kill a law enforcement officer, kidnapped a civilian, and then turned out to be an absolute waste of time for the FBI.
You don't understand. He's got guys on the inside there. No enemy of Anthony fucking Hugo survives a week in that hellhole, he insisted.
I leaned forward. Then give me something I can use. Tell me what you know about Felix. Why did your father commission the list from him?
Duncan swiped a hand over his sweaty upper lip.
Felix is like a squirrel, you know? Always scurrying around, picking up little nuggets here and there, storing them away for winter or a payday. He was a likable guy for a dirtbag, a real charmer. He was like Kevin Bacon on the streets. Everyone either knew him or knew a guy who knew him. If you needed intel, he could usually dig it up.
Who did he work with? Who were his friends? I asked.
Like I said, everyone knew him. Everyone liked him.
Then who was he closest to? Maybe someone outside the game?
Nolan prompted. Duncan tipped his head to the ceiling.
I don't fucking know. Maybe his girl?
He had a woman? I asked. Nolan and I shared a glance. This was news.
One he paid for, if that counts. I saw him once having lunch with her, real high class. Way too good for him.
What was her name? I asked. He took a drag and blew out a cloud of smoke that swirled lazily between us.
Maureen Fitzgerald.
I sat back in my seat. Duncan's smirk was back.
Huh. Maybe you're a client, too? Isn't that a small, incestuous world?
Prisons give me the heebie-jeebies,
Nolan announced when we hit the parking lot, the barbed wire and block walls behind us.
Every time I walk in, I'm worried they aren't going to let me walk out.
I grunted and continued toward my car.
Was it my imagination in there, or did that ginger asshole insinuate that you were acquainted with Maureen Fitzgerald, DC's highest caliber madam?
Nolan wondered. I yanked open the door of my Jaguar and grabbed my phone. It wasn't your imagination, and I am acquainted with Maureen, I said, thumbs flying across the screen. Me. We need to talk. Call me.
Huh. Didn't think a guy like you would have to buy a date. Makes me feel pretty damn good about myself.
The phone vibrated in my hand, but it wasn't Maureen. It was Special Agent Idler. I swore under my breath, ignored the call, and slid behind the wheel. I never should have allowed Nolan to tag along. I needed to think, to plot. I didn't want the feds talking to Maureen before I did.
Get in, I ordered.
Hey, listen, you're the boss. You don't have to tell me anything as long as you keep paying me, Nolan said as he climbed into the passenger seat. I waited until both doors were closed. Maureen is a friend. She feeds me information on some of her more depraved client requests. I use that information as I see fit.
And you don't want to give the feds a reason to look directly at her,
Nolan guessed, securing his seatbelt. I nodded and started the engine.
Seems kind of odd. Maureen Fitzgerald associating with a Felix Metzer type? He mused. I've seen her in person a few times. Gorgeous lady, classy, rich.
It wasn't just odd. It was completely implausible. My phone vibrated again, and I fantasized about tossing it out the window and backing over it, but managed to refrain. A glance at the screen told me it wasn't Idler. Karen.
Tonight we will be dining on the finest frozen pizza and a reasonably okay-ish bottle of wine.
Fuck. I'd nearly forgotten. Big plans tonight? Nolan asked.
What? I looked up, intending to glare him into silence. He nodded at the screen in the dashboard where Karen's text was on display. Damn Bluetooth. Another call from Idler appeared on the screen.
You look like you're about to rip the wheel out of the steering column, Nolan observed mildly.
I gave him another cold glare.
Okay, fine. You don't look like it, but that's the vibe you're putting off. I'm observant as fuck. Don't hate me.
I'm fine, I insisted stiffly.
Here's what I'm thinking. You try to get a hold of your business associate, Maureen, and keep your dinner plans. My bride is working late tonight, prepping with her team for some big meeting tomorrow morning. Why don't you let me handle updating Idler?
I opened my mouth to give him a litany of reasons why that wouldn't be happening, but he pressed on.
I'll keep the madam out of it for now and stick to the sweet little shell company your team of hackers untangled 15 minutes ago.
What shell company? I demanded. And for legal reasons, you can't call them hackers.
The one digital security specialist Prairie texted me about.
Why didn't she contact me directly?
Because you're a scary motherfucker, man. No one actually likes talking to you. You make small talk feel like a root canal without anesthesia.
I do not, I argued, feeling surly.
Karen is Sloane's mom, isn't she?
He asked.
Yes. There are certain jobs you're uniquely suited for. Looking a politician in the eyes while you destroy his career, forking over a few million when the situation calls for it, calling the woman who runs the highest-priced call girl ring in the metro area, and visiting your friend while she's mourning her husband. I've got the rest of it covered.
I blew out a breath.
You aren't completely worthless as an employee. Thanks, boss. Those gold stars you're handing out get me right here, he said, thumping his chest.
My phone rang again. This time it was Petula.
What?
I snapped after hitting the answer button on the console. Nolan looked at me pointedly. I rolled my eyes.
Hello, Petula. What can I do for you? I said with exaggerated politeness.
Are you all right, sir? Are you under duress? I can have a security team to your location in minutes.
I'm fine, I said dryly. Don't worry, Petula. I won't let anything happen to the boss man, Nolan announced.
I'm delighted to hear that, she said dryly. However, we have a problem.
What is it? I demanded, my mind still focused on Duncan, Felix, and now Maureen.
When Holly went out to pick up lunch, she was chased by two men in a black Chevy Tahoe.
I accelerated out of the parking lot. Is she all right? Nolan asked.
His hand closed covertly over the door handle as the car fishtailed onto the road.
She's fine. A little shaken up, but her car wasn't so lucky, Petula reported. She got a partial license plate.
Run it, I said curtly. We'll be there in half an hour.
Black Tahoe sitting all by her lonesome, Nolan reported.
He handed me his binoculars. I frowned.
Where did you get those?
Never leave home without binoculars, a pocket knife, and snacks, he said sagely. Want some beef jerky?
What I want is payback, I muttered, peering through the binoculars and spotting the SUV in the parking lot of the luxury condo building. The vehicle was registered to one of Hugo's corporations. According to the mortgage on the three-bedroom Alexandria condo, it was owned by one of Hugo's enforcers.
Did you tell security to deliver the company Escalade to Holly's place? Nolan said.
Yeah.
Lena and Petula are going along to make sure the kid isn't still freaked out. Hell of an upgrade over a 12-year-old sedan with primer gray trunk.
I handed the binoculars back to him and said nothing. It was the least I could do. I'd been prepared for Hugo's escalation, but I'd been anticipating him escalating things with me, not an employee on a salad run. He'd sent a message, made an example. I'd overestimated his sense of fair play, and one of my people paid the price. It wouldn't happen again.
Stay here, I ordered, and opened the van door.
I'd borrowed a cargo van from the security team. It was my turn to send a message.
Sorry, boss, no can do.
Nolan slipped out the passenger door. He pulled a black wool cap out of his coat pocket and yanked it down over his head.
I'm about to break half a dozen laws, I warned, before rounding the back of the vehicle.
And here I thought you'd have minions for that, Nolan said, opening the cargo doors. I grabbed the sledgehammer.
Sometimes it's better to get your own hands dirty, and by that I mean my hands, not yours.
He picked up the 6-foot coil of material off the van floor.
Can't let you have all the fun. Besides, if we get caught, your scary lawyers will have me out before my ass touches a holding cell bench.
I was oddly touched. I gave an exasperated sigh.
Fine. Let's go play with fire.
I didn't wait for an answer and headed into the shadows.
Never got to have fun like this in my last job, Nolan whispered gleefully behind me.
You're late, Karen announced, opening the door with feigned motherly disappointment.
I leaned down and pressed a kiss to her cheek. I was late and exhausted, but vengeance had dulled the rage. Now I was almost cheerful. It had been a while since I'd gotten my hands dirty.
I'm sorry. There was a situation that I needed to deal with, I explained, slipping off my coat.
You're late. You smell like gasoline and smoke, and your coat is torn, she noted as I hung it on the rack inside the door.
All reasons why I could use a large glass of this mediocre wine you promised.
The explosion had happened a little earlier than anticipated. Nolan's giddy, holy fucking shit, still rang in my ears.
Knox would have been proud. Nash would have been furious. As for me, I was starting to appreciate Nolan as more than a minion.
Follow me, my dear, Karen said, leading the way toward the kitchen.
The condo was nothing like the family home in Knockemout. I'd chosen it for proximity to the hospital, not personality. But in the 2 years that they'd lived here, Karen had managed to convert the off-white-walled blank slate into a comfortable home. The large framed photo of Simon, Sloan, and me the day Sloan got her driver's license caught my attention, as it always did, though this time it delivered a punch to the gut in addition to the twinge of regret I usually felt. Simon wasn't waiting for me in the kitchen like he had been for so many years of my life. I didn't know how Karen managed to stay here, surrounded by memories of a life she'd never get back. She was barefoot and casually dressed in a pair of leggings and an oversized sweater. Her hair was held back from her face with a wide, paisley-patterned headband. I liked that there was no formality among the Waltons. The women I dated, however briefly, were never seen without a full face of makeup, their hair perfectly coiffed, and their wardrobes ready to be whisked away to the symphony, Paris, or a black tie fundraiser.
You sit, I'll pour, Karen insisted when we entered the small but efficient kitchen.
She'd painted the walls a sunny yellow and swapped out the sedate white quartz countertops for terracotta tiles topped with cobalt blue accessories. I pulled out an upholstered stool in tangerine corduroy and reached for the appetizer plate. There was always a can of my favorite smoked almonds in Karen Walton's pantry. She stocked them alongside Maeve's favorite cereal and Sloan's root beer, as if I too were one of the family.
How is it being back? I asked.
She slid a wine glass in my direction and picked up her own.
Terrible. Okay, haunting, comforting, a never-ending misery, a relief, you know, the usual.
We could have rescheduled, I said. Karen managed a small, pitying smile as she moved to the oven.
Sweetie, when will you learn that sometimes being alone is the last thing you need?
Never. She snorted and opened the oven door, filling the room with the scent of store-bought pizza. I got off my stool and rounded the island to nudge her out of the way. You get the salad, I'll cut the slices. You always cut them crooked, I teased. She also never remembered to wash the cheese off the pizza cutter, which resulted in a congealed mess that required serious muscle. She handed over the utensil.
Teamwork makes the dream work.
We both froze. I'd heard the phrase a few hundred thousand times in the Walton kitchen, mostly from Simon when he and Karen shared meal prep duties. I didn't know where to look. The glimpse of raw grief as it flitted across her face was like a knife to my heart. I wasn't equipped to deal with emotions like that. I handled problems, presented solutions. I didn't navigate personal loss with someone, no matter how much I loved them. Karen was more of a mother to me than my own, and Simon had been the kind of father I wished I'd deserved. She cleared her throat and pasted a cheerful look on her pretty face.
How about we just pretend everything is normal for a while?
She suggested. Fine, but don't think that I'll let you win at rummy just because you're a widow now, I warned. Karen's laugh was nothing like Sloane's. It was a loud, joyous guffaw that made my chest feel warm and bright. Sloane's was a throaty chuckle that went straight to my gut. I could picture her across the table, smiling at me as if we weren't poisoned to each other. A sharp, burning sensation against my thumb yanked me back to the present moment. I adjusted my grip on the potholder. I'd managed to set fire to a vehicle without burning myself, but give me a frozen pizza and time to think about a certain blonde librarian, and my guard crumbled. I forcibly blocked the vexatious vixen from my mind and focused on the wall.